Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 30th of December. Our guest writes in his just-released book, Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. Life goes fast. Click. You are 15. Click, click. You are 55. Click, click. You are gone. And so are the people who loved and nurtured you. With that thought in mind, and because he had just lost his job, he was a workaholic in his mid-50s, a job in the publishing industry. He had been editor of Parade magazine. Our guest, Lee Kravitz, received a lot of boxes in the mail and from his job, and he started going through all of those boxes. There were many of them. It led to some pretty deep soul searching, and Lee decided that he was going to take care of unfinished business in his life, dealing with his family, paying back a loan, visiting people who had been extremely important early in his life, trying to make amends with family members and bring family members together. And it's a lovely book that looks at what matters in our lives, which a lot of us think about as we approach the end of a year. It's what I do. I'm not a partier. I never have been. I always think about the people who came before me and how important they were and what, you know, the whole meaning of life thing. That's what goes on internally with me on New Year's Eve. So Lee has some fascinating stories to tell and important stories to tell about his unfinished life, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls if you would like to join this conversation in the final days of 2010. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you would like, and that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Lee.
Hi.
Hi.
It's nice to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I've just spent most of yesterday reading your book, and it's always fun to actually hear the voice of the person whose thoughts I know pretty deeply at this point in time. So it's a good thing. I really like the book. You just pick the right people to talk to, and you go through this spiritual journey and this family journey. And what a good thing for you to have done, because you will inspire so many others to do the same thing, don't you think?
Yeah, I hope so. At least I've been getting a lot of really positive response around the country and whenever I speak, and from readers of the book, because there is, as you say, not just at this end of a year and beginning of another year, people really searching for purpose and meaning in their lives. And I think over the last few years, when we've had such an uncertain economy, and so many of the principles that we've lived by have been turned on their head, people are starting to reevaluate their lives and trying to set new priorities for themselves. And I think the book taps into that.
You had to find quite a few people who were in this book. Let's start with finding Fern, because
yes,
she's such a wonderful person, and you just changed her life dramatically by finding her.
It was Fern was my aunt. You mentioned those 10 boxes of books and letters and relics from my past. Well, one of the most touching was a birthday card I received from my aunt Fern in 1986 when I was 33 years old. And when I looked at it, I just remembered how much she had loved me and I had loved her. Fern was the aunt I had in my life who gave me unconditional love when I was young, and we shared secrets together. And she was also clinically a paranoid schizophrenic who'd been institutionalized on and off for much of her life. Well, when I looked at that birthday card, I realized I hadn't seen her in 15 years and didn't have any idea where she was, nor did anyone in my family. Fern had gotten into a fight with my grandmother, who had Alzheimer's, who she was living with, and of course, one person who has schizophrenia and another has Alzheimer's. It's not a great combination for taking care of each other. They can't take care of themselves, And the police came and took her away and institutionalized her. And word came down that none of us in the family should see Fern, because if we did, it might spark deep, dark memories that would lead her to do as so many times before she had tried to commit suicide.
Mm.
So for 15 years, I hadn't seen Fern, and no one had. But I knew once I saw that birthing card that this was ridiculous. This is a person I cared and loved deeply, and I couldn't live the rest of my life or with myself if I didn't at least attempt to see her again.
Mm-hmm.
And I tracked her down. She was outside of Cleveland in a special care facility, and I remember walking in to that facility so full of fear. I mean, it took me about 3 hours to get there. It was only a half-hour drive because I kept making stops. I don't even eat McDonald's, but I kept stopping at McDonald's and having meals to put off the moment that I would see or not see Fern.
Wow.
I got there, and as you read in the book, they wheeled her out of the lunchroom, and I fully expected her not to recognize me. And she said, "Lee Richard Kravitz, my brilliant nephew."
Oh,
and she shouted to everyone in the place, "Lee Richard Kravitz is here to visit me, everyone. Hug me, Lee Richard."
Oh.
And so I hugged her, and it was for 10 minutes, the most incredible hug. I mean, maybe you've experienced it when the weight falls off your shoulders. And we were both so deeply entwined. And for the past 3 years, we've been very involved with each. I've been very involved in her life. She gave me this tremendous gift of rediscovering the part of myself that could care about another person. And she hadn't had a single visitor in 15 years.
Isn't that something?
And not one visitor in 15 years. And since that time, she had a few. And I say this at the moment, special feeling, because, and it's the first time I'm talking about it, so I'm quite emotional. She died.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On Thursday.
Oh, my goodness. She died. No, I'm going to cry. She died on Thursday.
She died on Thursday, and one of the reflections I had was that if I had not intervened and tried to find her, she would have died alone and probably been cremated. And there would have been no ceremony. And she really wanted to be buried next to her former husband. And I made sure that those arrangements were there. And her brother, who she had not seen in so many years, came in to orchestrate the very, very small ceremony. And I felt that that wonderful closure, I just felt that, you know, that there was closure.
Right.
To the whole thing that feels so right to me.
You found her in time. And you brought her all these memories. She asked for pictures, and you brought her this scrapbook, which is the best possible present you can ever give anybody. But all these pictures that connected her with her earlier life.
It did, because people told me that, oh, she doesn't want to remember her earlier life. But she really did want to remember the happy moments in her life. And I made this scrapbook for her. She told me that the thing that had hurt her most over those 14 years, 15 years without seeing people, was that when November 4th would come about, there'd be no birthday party for her, no recognition, no cards, no phone calls. So I pledged after I first saw her to throw her birthday party on November 4th, which I did. And gave her this scrapbook of pictures. And Fern had been trained to be a concert pianist when she was young, and had, of course, not been playing much for the last 30 years. But after she got her presents, she asked to be wheeled to the piano in the special care facility. And she sat there and played the old songs from our youth, you know, all the wonderful Sound of Music, Camelot songs, Yiddish songs, and they were a little rusty, but beautiful, beautiful music. And I last saw her, and each year I visited her the last 3 years on her birthday. So I got to see her on November 4th for her birthday.
Oh, I love this story. And those songs that she played also reminded you of the best parts of your youth, and your youth was, one might say, a little rocky.
Yeah, it was at a time when the happiest moments I had from when I was young was sitting around at age 8 or 9 and 10. The piano, as Fern played, my whole family was together and relatively happy, singing along with her. That was by far the happiest memory I have of youth, because by a few years later, my family had become lost all its money and was embittered and dysfunctional, and there were lots of troubling things that happened when I was growing up. But I have this wonderful memory of the golden age of my family, with Fern at the center, but playing those tunes on the piano.
Oh, and you got to have it again. Oh, it's quite a story.
So thank you for letting me talk about her.
Yeah, I had no idea she had died, and it is such a touching part of the book.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, though. Let's go back a few steps. You hadn't talked to Fern in 15 years. Let's talk about the part of your life before this unfinished business took place. And I'm sure that it's familiar to a lot of people. You just didn't think about these things, or you put them in some other part of your mind. What was going on? You were just working really hard, or what?
Yeah, I was so compartmentalized in my life, and like many people, I mean, on my level, I was a workaholic. So I was going 24/7. I had a job which was very demanding, editor-in-chief of Parade, which, as you know, is the largest circulation publication in the country. But even when I was around my three young kids, even when I was in their presence, I wasn't present for them. I could be irritable. Work was always on my mind. I had become disconnected, and this is what I realized after I lost my job, which was my identity. I had become disconnected from the people who had been important in my life, not only my wife and three kids, but friends from the past and people who had helped shape my life. I had this stunning realization of that. You know, unfinished business, and we all have it, comes for a simple reason. I mean, all of us have very full lives. And if you work and you are a parent raising children, if you're a son or daughter to parents, you know, you have a full life. And so some of the most important things in your life get put on the to-do list, the perpetual to-do list. And when I was confronted with that feeling of emptiness and being disconnected, I had a pretty long to-do list. And what I ended up doing was narrowing it down to 10 items that I really felt of emotional and spiritual business that I wanted to address, that I knew I had to address if I was to move forward in my life. And that's how that whole process came about.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing to me that many of these people you went to visit, you hadn't seen Lee in years and years and years. And yet, and I think all of us have the fear, oh, nobody's going to remember me. They're never going to think that I was anybody at all. But you had made profound connections with a number of these people, and they more than remembered you. They had the pretty deep connection with you that goes way back.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens when, you know, there's so many, part of what creates unfinished business is that we have fears, and the fears keep us from reaching out or reaching back in our past or connecting with people. So I had this ongoing fear, oh, they're never going to remember me, or they're mad at me. I was a nobody to them. And as I reached out to a friend who I played high school baseball with, or a monk who had been my friend and spiritual partner when I was in high school, you know, people like that, it turned out that we had very profound, profound connections. The other thing it had was that we became a way for each of us to get some perspective on the lives we had lived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was at that stage when I began reaching out to people completely in need of confidence again. And I found it in the reflections they had of me when I was 16, 17, and 18 years old. One of the people that I reached out to was a teacher, a mentor.
Oh, I love that story. Father Jarvis?
Father Jarvis,
yeah.
know, we all have a person in our lives who recognized in us what we didn't see in ourselves, and he was that person when I was in high school and troubled, and my family was having tough times. There was a teacher, an Episcopal priest at the school I went to, who really saw in me the talent to write and to think, but, you know, like we do so much in my life, I had never thanked him. I hadn't seen him since high school. This person had such a profound effect on my life. So I tracked him down. When I'd last seen him, he was about 29 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
16, 17, and now he was approaching 70. We spent 4 days together kind of resuming the conversation about God and the meaning of life that we had that had been the basis of our class, the class I had taken from him. And getting to thank him was a profoundly meaningful experience for me. He wasn't seeking my thanks, but I think it's something he enjoyed. And being around someone who had seen something in me before at a time, now at age 54, that I was feeling kind of without a foundation and unconfident, and was amazing. And it was such an affirmation of my life to have made that connection with him.
Oh, I am so glad you went back to visit him. And the thing that he taught you, and that we all don't seem to want, it's interesting, we started this with the death of Fern, that he's a big believer in making us all aware that, you know, we're going to die. We're going to die.
Yeah, that's his theme. I mean, he kept quoting to me, it was Mark, the Gospel of Mark 13:33, which is, take heed, for you not know when your time will come, which is saying that we all die. Death is the one thing we know about our life, that we all know we're going to die.
Yes.
You never know when it could happen tomorrow. And that gives an urgency to your life now. And it really helped me put my unfinished business in perspective, because so much, you know, we put off the important stuff. We put off reaching out to people from our past. We put off thanking them. We put off telling people what they mean to us because we think we're going to see them again. Well, that's not really how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Either you or that person can be gone in a second. And if you kind of keep that in your mind, it's not a negative thought. It's actually a positive one. It says, really give of yourself right now. And don't put off expressing the important things to other people or being kind. We're doing the right thing.
Lee Kravitz, our guest, kind of a perfect end-of-the-year guest, isn't he? His book is Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. It's a great title for the book as well. We have a number of people who want to speak with you. Our lines are all filled. Let me give you the phone number, and a few people will talk, and there will be openings. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Lee Kravitz, our guest, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number for Lee is 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. We'll get to many of the other stories as we go through this hour, but I want to include our audience. Sean from Warren's, the first call, Lee. Hi, Sean. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
Hi.
I actually had a question for Sam.
For Lee?
For Sam.
For Sam. Who's Sam?
Hello?
Yeah, I we'll just put you on hold so you can get things straightened out because I'm not sure who you're talking to. Let's go to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I wondered, you know, I've heard stories somewhat like this and have read about them, of course, where people who were either mentally ill or people wanted to get out of the way were institutionalized and spent the rest of their lives in an institution, sometimes very talented people. I wondered how your guest how he felt about the rest of his family who hadn't visited his aunt or great aunt, I can't remember which it is, for 15 years and just left her all alone, you know, and apparently she was talented and she must have had some good qualities. It seems so cold-blooded, and I wondered whether he needed to forgive his family or whether he could or what his feelings about the other members of his family were.
Thank you for asking that. It's hard to judge people if you've judge yourself. I mean, I had been a person who, for 15 years, had not made the attempt to see her as well. So it wasn't, I had some understanding that there were barriers to seeing her, and that each individual might have had their reasons. I'm happy to say that once I went to see her and communicated that to other people, two others of my relatives went to see her, her brother and my brother, and at least they became part of her life. My father, on the other hand, never saw her again. That was her sister, and I'm sure he was filled with all these feelings of guilt and shame and not having been able to make her life perfect that made it very hard to see her. So I felt somewhat compassionate to those who had made a different decision than me.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ann. Tell the story of this guy, and when you tell the story, you think, oh, he was horrible to you. He was trying to hurt you intentionally. The story of Tripp and what happened to Tripp. Because he stayed with you for years.
Yeah, Tripp was the scourge of my childhood bully. I think a lot of us have experienced that person who seems to just want to undermine us. Well, Tripp was that person to me. I was on the football team, and even though he's on the same team as me in a scrimmage, he connived to knock out my tooth to make me look bad so he could move ahead. We competed for captain of the baseball team, but he launched a campaign against me. I mean, this guy was always doing everything he could to make my life miserable.
He even got you off the student council, didn't he?
And I always felt there were anti-Semitic underpinnings.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought of him as my Hitler. It became so extreme. So of course I just wished the worst for him. You know, actively wished just that bad things would befall him. And then he would plague my nightmares and my dreams. You know, how some people just take residence in your mind.
Sure.
Long after, he would always be there, kind of laughing at me and scorning me and undermining me. Well, I heard one day though that this was about the time I lost my job, that Tripp had died a horrible death with two empty bottles of vodka by the side of the road. And he'd been an alcoholic and had lived a miserable life. And then all of a sudden, I felt sort of funny about wishing him so much harm. I mean, there was nothing sweet about his horrible life to me. And I felt that I had, that I needed to make amends for just wishing the worst on him. It was just, I had an ugly feeling about myself. But as I tried to figure out a way to make amends, I talked with old friends of his and found out that, you know, I had thought that I was the only one he tormented, which made me feel special in a way. But the fact was, he was an equal opportunity tormentor. And when I realized that it really wasn't about me and that it wasn't a matter of his being just pointedly anti-Semitic, even though that was part of it, it allowed me to look at myself rather than him. And it actually helped me to change my feelings toward the people who had fired me from my job, you know, who had become my new bullies in my mind.
Right.
And I started to think that maybe I had had some complicity by not making my bosses feel comfortable, or that I was there for them, or whatever it was, I began to look at my own complicity in the bullying, perceived bullying. So I went through some sort of transformation. You know, it was almost a gift that Tripp gave me in self-awareness, in forgiving him. But the real lesson for me there was how so often we, you know, our demons are the product of our blowing them way out of proportion.
You went through, that was a very large thing you went through, what you just described. Because
yeah.
It stayed, that resonance in the mind, we all know that. We people who we feel have really done us wrong and have been mean to us, and they can just be in your mind for a long, long time.
And they take on and it has nothing to do with those people at some point in your life. They've just
right.
taken up residence there. And
yes, right.
They've become symbols of something else, and uh-huh. you've got to kind of address that something else.
Let's go to Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Well, you know, this is not something I would normally call in about, but Lee, your stories are so similar to what I've been experiencing that I just decided I would. And I had a sister who was 53, and she was the person I was most close to when I was a kid. And she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer around Thanksgiving, and she died 12 days later. It was really, really aggressive. And in that time, I spent a lot of that time with her, and fortunately, we were able to say the things we had to say to each other. And but what I wanted to say was that even though I've been aware, you know, I think I've thought a lot about the fact that we all could die at any time, we all will die at any time, to actually see it happen to the person you're most close to, completely different experience. And I mean, it was just so shocking. And but now knowing that that's the reality, it completely changes my idea of what life is, and it will change the way it already has changed the way the rest of our family relates to each other, and you know how we relate to everybody, and then just the other thing is just if I had had any idea that this is how my relationship with my sister would end, how incredibly differently we would have, if she had known, if I had known, how differently everybody would have behaved, and you know, the way we would have lived would have been so much different. And it would be, I wish that there was a way to convey this to people so that they could understand it without having to actually experience it. I don't know if that's possible, but.
And what would you have done, Sarah? What would you have done differently?
I would have been a lot more open. I would have not held things back, like Leah's saying. You know, we were supposed to have a lot of defensiveness and fear about being open with each other. And, you know, once she was diagnosed and I saw her on the edge of dying, I mean, how none of that just, it's like it just disappeared. It just fell away.
Yes.
Well, I'm so sorry for your loss and also happy that you've attained this kind of wisdom that you're going to apply to your life going forward and that you've just shared with the audience. So I think that's going to be very powerful for a lot of people. It's amazing to me how many stories I've heard like yours where it's the death of a parent or a sibling that brings estranged family members finally together. It becomes the catalyst for reconciliation. You know, since so many families, people hold grudges for reasons they can't even remember. As I've gone on the road talking about my book, it's incredible how many brothers and sisters haven't talked to each other in 10, 15, 20 years, or treated each other badly over issues of money and inheritance. And then all of a sudden, when there's a death, it seems so trivial and shallow, the grudges that we've held and the hurt that we've created through our estrangement. So I just thank you for this story because it really, I think, inspires me and others to be more open in their lives.
Yeah, it sure does. Thank you very much for the call. How have things changed in your immediate family with your children, with your wife, as a result of this journey?
Well, I think I'm much more present. I mean, my wife might challenge that. Yeah, once a workaholic, always a workaholic. But I certainly am just full of, at least the way I'm experiencing it, so much more appreciation for all she does, for what a wonderful mother she is. For my children, it's just a tremendous experience, probably the most exciting thing in my life. Is to watch them grow up, and even though it's gotten more and more challenging as they've gone and become teenagers in the last
year, I fully understand that.
I must confess, it is clear that I've my priorities have been recalibrated, and that whatever I do going forward, the family and my engagement with them comes first. So I think, you know, I can't say that everything is always perfect because I don't think life's like that. We don't kind of all of a sudden, all kind of get along smoothly, but I'm more engaged.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more connected. And I think they feel the results of that connection.
No, they'd have to.
That's been the big, lesson for me. Is that just by taking the steps to make amends, to reach out, to reconnect with people, there's an immediate reward, and there are also lasting rewards. And the greatest reward of all is that you just become tuned into the vibrancy of human connectedness. That's really thrilling.
That's a nice way to describe it. It's thrilling. Let's go to David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Hello. So many things. I first called in when your comment about your work. I've been many jobs, and all those jobs and relationships, there's only one relationship that is still a friend after I left the jobs. I mean, we put all this energy into work, and, hey, once you leave that job, most likely you're never going to see these people again. Like I said, I have only one friendship that actually started at a work situation that I still am friends with. Also, the other day, a big hunk of ice hit me in the head. I got a nice gash on my nose. If that was a bigger piece of ice, I could have been dead.
Oh,
and
wow.
One of the last thing is that I lost a friend, not through white call. It was putting things off. I was going to contact him, but I didn't. Turned out he moved. And then I went call. Then I'm hoping that he would contact me, but then I moved. And now I don't know where he's at. He doesn't know where I'm at. Matter of fact, Phil Verde, if you hear me, I'm in Ironwood, Michigan.
Oh.
I'm in the phone book. This is Dave. Who knows?
Who knows, Dave? That's one of the wonderful things about radio sometimes. But I think you might be inspired. It took some doing for you to find some of these people in your book, didn't it?
It did. But I do want to tell you, Dave, that in this day and age of the Internet, with a little bit of research and Googling, it's so much easier now than 20 years ago to find people. And I wouldn't be surprised, since word has just gone out over the radio, that you do get contacted, because even though we have billions of people on this earth, the connection, you know, is so slim. One person knows another person knows another person, and your friend and you will be reconciled with some effort. So to answer your question, it does take work, it takes focus, it takes intention. You know, you have to really want it to happen, but it can be done. You can find almost anyone and reach out to them. And the way that the connections become most meaningful and work best is if you go in with a absolutely open and sincere heart. That's in one case after another. I so much wanted to either reconnect or reconcile or make amends that that seemed to open doors that might have emotional doors that might have otherwise been shut from people. So it can be done, and it's worth the effort. And sometimes you'll, you know, find someone, it didn't happen to me, but I've heard it over and over again, that might not want you in their lives again. Don't take it personally. You know, try your best. Say your piece. Be compassionate towards them. And never push yourself when it might create hurt in their lives. There was one reader who wrote me that he had wronged some woman when she was 19. They were both 19, and now he was 63, and he was going to die within the next year or so, and he wanted her to know how sorry he was for wronging her. Excuse me. So he sent a certified letter to her home explaining how he felt bad about everything he had done. And guess who opened it?
Ooh.
Right, her husband. And so he hadn't heard back, but he still couldn't die, he said, without knowing that she knew how badly he felt.
Mm-hmm.
I said, just, you know, be happy that you feel this way, that you've come to feel sorry for what you've done, and that you wish the best in her life, but don't push it so you might upset her current happiness.
Mm-hmm. And what's your friend's name again, Dave?
Phil Verding.
Phil Verding.
Yeah.
Phil Verding. Okay. Phil Verding, call Dave.
The Philippines. So, so anyway.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Thanks very much for the call. All right. Let's pause for just a moment and welcome more phone calls. I guess this hour is the author of Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things, which is a perfect description of what this book is about. Lee Kravitz is our guest. And we have lines open for the first time. And you can send an email, too, if you don't feel comfortable calling. The phone number, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest, Lee Kravitz. The book is Unfinished Business. Let's go back to a couple more of the profoundly moving stories in this book. And the gentleman who was a very good friend of yours who lost his daughter reporting in Iraq, she did. And you saw the notice, but you just, well, what happened? Tell the story.
Well, this is when I was still at parade. And I opened up the New York Times one day and saw this picture of this lovely young woman, just beautiful, but the story said that she had been ambushed and blown up in Baghdad when being part of a peace peace mission. And then I looked at her, and there's something very familiar about her. And then I looked at her name, Andy Parhamovich, and said she was from Perry, Ohio. And then I immediately realized that she was the daughter of someone I had played baseball with 40 years earlier on a state championship baseball team. His name was Andre Parhamovich. And it just was devastating to me. Even though I hadn't seen Andre in 40 years, I felt so sorry for him. And I sat at my desk writing condolence cards for 3 days and tearing them up. You know, as I began to examine why I was tearing them up, it was because I was afraid that anything I would say might be trivial. He might not even remember me. Who was I to intrude on the grief of this person? This was being covered at the time, and every news station in the country was covering this event. And he was nowhere to be seen. He was just referred to as the grieving father. So, you know, I kept tearing them up and not doing it. And then there was one other fear I had that I wasn't even conscious of at the time, was that I was afraid of something like that happening to my daughter.
Yes,
only,
right.
11 at the time, but still the thought of that happening to her was just unthinkable. So I didn't send any condolence card. I let the life take over and all the deadlines of putting out a magazine. But once I had lost my job and I was trying to deal with my unfinished business, this rose pretty high, the fact of wanting to send him the condolence card or make a condolence call to him is something I should have done. And I finally did it, and we reconnected, and he did remember who I was. And what I did was I didn't even say I'm sorry for your loss. What I actually did was I had brought along a article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer in 1969 with our team picture.
Hmm.
You know, after we won the state championship, and I'd Googled every player on the team and found out what they were, had done with their lives.
Hmm.
And I reported this on to him. And I brought back, then there are seven of the guys had been drafted into the pros.
Isn't that something?
And six of them had become coaches. He had become a coach of a high school team, but one of them was the coach of the USA Olympic team. It was a great team of ball players. And we talked and talked, and this kind of gave him a vacation from grief. I mean,
yes,
he was a
right.
destroyed man. He'll mm-hmm. always, to some extent, I mean, he and I every week still, email each other and see each other as much as we can. But the amazing thing, not only did he get a vacation from grief and I resolved that bit of unfinished business, is he began to mentor me in terms of my relationship with my own sons. I had shied away from becoming their baseball coach on their little league team because I didn't want to become the overwhelming presence in their lives that my father was in mine. I mean, I could go into a lot of detail
mm-hmm.
about it, but it wasn't a pretty experience for me being having a father who really was pushing me to become a major league player and pushed me to injury. And I didn't want to do that to my kids, but my friend Andre said, really, do this. Not only will it be great for you and your kids, but it'll also be great for your dad. I mean, he had some instinct about that. And so he mentored me, and I became the coach of this team. And after every game, I would send both Andre and my father a letter on what happened and what I did as a coach and so on. And for the first, and my father would write me back. And I found myself listening to his advice for the first time in many, many years. You know, I would never listen to what my father advised. And as I listened to his advice, I grew more compassionate toward my dad. And it really changed, transformed my feelings towards my father and my relationship with him. All thanks to my reaching out to my friend who had lost his daughter.
And you also were able to become involved in baseball again, which you obviously yes. love.
Oh, my deepest love. My deepest love. You know, it seems crazy now that I would deprive myself
right, it
of
does.
Something that meant so much to me when
uh-huh.
I was growing up, that I loved so deeply, and the joy I've had being involved in my kids' discovery of baseball and is, wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's great that it's in my life again.
Mm. Judy is calling from Green Bay. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have enjoyed very much listening to this program and added yet another wonderful book title to purchase. I'm afraid the list is very long. But I was thinking of something that I read someplace a couple of years ago, and I don't know who wrote it, but it goes as follows, and I think it applies to many of us, if not all of us. If you truly love someone, you will learn the song they keep in their heart so that you can sing it to them when they forget the words.
Oh, my.
It's a very beautiful sentiment.
And I have found myself including that in many of the notes that I have been writing to friends in the last couple of years who have lost someone close to them or are going to lose someone close to them. And it helps.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you again for the program.
Thank you, Judy. Thanks so much for the call. Oh, so much good has come from this, hasn't it? You got fired and look at all the good you've done.
No kidding.
Really?
No kidding. but that's what it takes sometimes. It takes a trauma to to get you out of your habitual life and way of thinking and really begin to see the world with clearer eyes and take the actions that bring blessings to
all. Yes. So this story reminded me of the $500 that I borrowed from my mother because I was, you know, and unfortunately I never paid her back. My car broke down, and she kept this secret until her, you know, she kept the secret that I had borrowed the money because my dad said, don't buy the damn car, it's going to fall apart. And he was right, and he couldn't find out. And so she generously gave me $500 to rebuild the car in Ohio, actually, before I was continuing my cross-country trip to find the perfect happiness. I'm not sure. But I never got a chance to pay her back because but I forgot about it, you know, and she died. But you borrowed, was it $600 from a friend?
$600, yeah, and borrowed it.
Yeah, that's a great story because it takes us all over the world.
It does. When I left college and pooled together a little bit of money, I took off on a journey with two college friends who bought a Land Rover in London and traveled over the course of a year to India. We went overland through countries that you can't do this anymore. We went through Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, Nepal.
My.
We went through wars and had all these adventures, adventures at age 22 that I had. And then all of a sudden I found myself in Varanasi, the Hindu holy city. And I remember the moment when we were watching, my two friends and I, watching these bodies be burnt, which is, you know, the Hindu cremation ceremonies on the edge of the Ganges River. And I realized I didn't have a cent in my pocket and I had no money to my name. And so I borrowed $600 from my much better off traveling companion and told him that as soon as I get back to Ohio and get back home, I'll pay him back. Well, of course, I get back to Ohio eventually, about 2 years later. And once I'd made $600 bartending, I needed it for rent. And then I needed it for eating and needed it for grad school. And so, of course, I didn't contact him or pay it back. And then in my mind, the $600 kept growing. It became $6,000 in my mind.
Ooh.
And probably $6 million in my mind over the years. And for 33 years, I didn't contact the person who I had shared the greatest adventures of my life with, you know, traveling overland through these wild and exciting places in the world. And then, so as part of my unfinished business, I decided I'd finally pay him back. And I sent him a check for $600 and said, use it how you will. And he wrote me back and said, he didn't even remember loaning me six. He had no idea what I was talking about. I mean, the $6 million in my mind was actually $0 to him. But he did give the money to his own son, who was 22, the age we traveled, so that his son could go on a trip.
I love this story. Great.
Symmetry to it.
Yes.
And then for interest, I flew out to Denver where he was and spent time remembering with him, remembering the great adventures of our lives and reconnecting. And that was a wonderful experience. And then I brought that feeling of adventure, because I'm feeling really adventurous now, realizing how brave I once was, fending off bandits, jumping on the Land Rover, you know, bullets flying.
My, right. You were adventurous.
And I went back home to my kids, who thought I was the least adventurous person in the world, always at my computer, you know, working, never
yes.
going on the trips or staying back at a hotel while everybody went sledding or skiing, and I started to participate more in their lives and felt more adventurous myself again. So it was a wonderful, you know, circle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's
coming
great.
Back to that. I remembered that I had a part to myself, adventurousness, which I'd really forgotten.
Right. Oh, it's wonderful to find that again. Let's just take a quick, we only have about 15 seconds, Deborah, but you can probably say, can you, in 15 seconds from Milwaukee? Are you there? Deborah's not. Yeah, go ahead quickly, please.
Okay. Well, I have a couple, but I sailed to England with three other people, and I and one of the only person that was from America was Doug. His name was Doug Fogg. He was from Boston, and I've been trying to find him. That's one situation. But what?
All right, I'm going to need to hold you at that situation, and may you find Doug in 2011. Lee, thank you so much for writing the book. It's I think you wrote a very important book, and that must feel good.
It does. Thank you for giving for talking with me today, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you as well. Lee Kravitz, the book is Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and have a wonderful new year. We'll be with you again on Monday with all things political, and look forward to more books and more conversations and learning more and appreciating each other. This is the Ideas Network.